Welcome to the Strange Matters Podcast, where we discuss anything and everything that is bizarre, mysterious, and unexplained. I am Ethan, joined with my fellow hosts,
Sean,
and Eric. On today's episode, we are going to be discussing three very strange cases of unsolved disappearances.
Each of these cases involve one or more people that suddenly, and without clear explanation, disappeared and leave us no proof of what exactly caused them to go missing. Each of us has an interesting story about a famous disappearance and whatever theories exist that can possibly explain what happened to them. First up on today's episode, we have Sean and his very creepy case of an unsolved disappearance.
Alright, so my disappearance is about the Eileen Moore Lighthouse. So this unsolved disappearance takes place in December of the year 1900 on a small island in the Flannan Isles off the coast of Scotland. The Eileen Moore Lighthouse sat on a small remote island which was completely uninhabited with the exception of three lighthouse keeper crew who was serving the lighthouse. The island did have some notoriety before this incident, as shepherds in times past had used it as a grazing spot for their sheep, but legend has it no one has ever stayed the night as they were fearful of the dark spirits which haunted the remote location. So I'm going to give some quick backstory about the lighthouse and the area. The Flannan Isles, also known as the Seven Hunters, are seven uninhabited islands, one of the most remote locations in the world. So many ships have been lost in that area that in 1895, a lighthouse was finally built on Eileen Moore, the largest of the islands. Eileen Moore has for centuries had an eerie reputation, for people living on the nearby larger island of Lewis would tell tales of a group of little people who resided there, said to possess strange magical powers, though this is most likely just the usual local superstitions. Once finished, the lighthouse would be operated by a three-man crew, and at the time of this mystery, those keepers were James Ducott, Thomas Marshall, and Donald MacArthur. All three men were pretty seasoned veterans of the storms. Ducott, who was 43 years old and the head keeper, had over 20 years experience at lighthouse keeping, while Marshall and MacArthur were both veterans of the sea themselves. The keepers worked on a rotating shift watch of 14 days. Food and supplies were brought to them as weather permitted. In mid-December, one of the three was due to return to the mainland for a break and be replaced by a keeper named Joseph Moore. So this mystery all began in the cold December days of 1900. A ship traveling to the Scottish island carrying the replacement crew member arrived to find that the lighthouse flag was not raised to greet them, and noticed that none of the three men were waiting for them at the island's dock, which was very odd considering the ship was running a few days late and the men on the island would be very happy to see the relief ship. Captain John Harvey blew the ship's horn multiple times, but to no avail, and even sent up a warning flare into the sky to get the attention of the men in the lighthouse. Still, no one came down to the docks, nor was there any visible activity on the island or on the lighthouse. Joseph Moore, who was to start his rotation at the lighthouse, took it upon himself to row to the island. After arriving, Joseph climbed the steep stairs through the morning fog that led to the lighthouse's entrance, and according to his reports later, he claimed to have felt a strong sense of foreboding as he approached the silent lighthouse. His feelings became even darker upon entering the lighthouse and finding no trace of the keepers who had been stationed there, or any clue as to what happened to any of them. Several other men came from the ship to help Moore search the island for its former inhabitants. What they did find only seemed to confuse them more. First, both the gate to the fence enclosing the lighthouse, along with the main door to the lighthouse, were both closed shut. However, the main door is unlocked. This is going to factor in later when we talk about the possible theories. Inside the lighthouse itself, Joseph Moore found that two of the oilskin coats worn by the keepers were gone, while one remained behind. In the kitchen, there was an overturned chair suggesting someone had left in a hurry. Due to a dramatized report later on, there's a common misconception that there was even a half-eaten plate of food left on the table, but this is completely false. The clocks had all been stopped, and the main lamp for the lighthouse had been filled, but was unlit, and all signs pointed to the fact that the men of the lighthouse had been empty for several days, perhaps even a full week. The men searched the logbooks to see if they could find any clues. Again, due to another false report later on that was published, many have heard the story believe that there are strange logs entered by one of the men, describing strong stormy weather and strange feelings around, writing that one of the others is deadly silent while the other sobs uncontrollably all day. However, these entries are again completely fictionalized, and in reality there is nothing amiss or unusual in the last few entries. The last entry into the lighthouse log was made on the morning of the 15th of December, 11 days previously before the ship arrived, and indicated nothing at all out of the ordinary. So these are the only clues. Nothing more has ever been found that gives any real explanation as to what happened to these men and what could cause three very experienced lighthouse keepers to just completely disappear. What do you guys think of this setting? It's just kind of creepy, this lighthouse, in stormy seas in the middle of nowhere.
I mean, it's definitely creepy. It reminds me of some strange movies that I've watched back in the day, but it's like your stereotypical setting of what haunting or disappeared should be. It's
You can see the intro, you know, a man, you know, climbing up through the fog to the White House and finding completely empty, searching room by room, seeing a few strange clues, but just nothing really that they can use to figure out what the heck happened.
I mean, it says the captain who was supposed to come relieve them was a few days late. Is it possible that they might have ran out of food or had some reason
they were still well-stocked. The relief ship was supposed to come every 14 days, but they had enough supplies. Because, I mean, it's stormy weather. They knew that sometimes they're going to be delayed. So, I mean, there was still food and supplies left in the White House. So I'm going to go over a few of the more popular theories. I'm going to go, in my opinion, from the least likely to the most likely. So one of the theories is that there was some kind of murder-suicide, that one of the lighthouse keepers, for some reason, either murdered one or two of them and threw them into the sea and then committed suicide himself, although there's really no evidence of foul play. And I don't see how it explains, you know, there's one oilskin suit left back in the lighthouse, and the gates and the door were closed. So I just don't see how any of these signs could really point to someone, for some reason, snapping and killing his two mates there.
Well, I mean, they don't necessarily have to snap. If somebody wants to kill two other men, then they can set up any kind of scenario that they want and make it look however they want it to appear. But what's missing is a motive. Is there a motive for...
Right, especially a murder-suicide.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, none of these three... And even if he did throw them into the sea, they said oftentimes when this happened, they would be washed ashore, and there's no signs of any bodies ever washing ashore to any of the nearby isles. Like you said, there's motive. There's nothing in the logs about anyone acting strange. These guys were all veterans. They knew each other. They were some of the best in the business just because they were working at such a remote and dangerous location. I just don't really buy into this theory at all. All right, so second theory is that these men were kidnapped, is that some ship full of hooligans somehow arrived on the island and decided to abduct the three lighthouse keepers.
What are we talking, a ship full of, like, high schoolers, or...
I'm going to get you!
I don't know. I mean, some kind of pirates or something, but once again, I mean, this is unlikely. What would anyone have to gain about capturing lighthouse keepers? And if you're going to abduct somebody, I mean, there are way easier ways to do it than going to a remote island and trying to dock there in the stormy seas.
Well, I think it's probably a logical explanation for what the captain saw when he came on the island and found practically no evidence.
Yeah.
But like you said, what's the point? Why would somebody sail to an island, kidnap some random people, and then leave?
Yeah.
I don't think that makes very much sense either.
Yeah, I don't really buy it. I think both those, the murder and the kidnapping, are pretty much 0% chance in my book.
Then give us what you think is good.
Alright, so I'm going to give a few of the more likely ones.
There we go.
One is obviously a storm. I mean, there was evidence of strong storms around this time. There was evidence that at one of the landing platforms, there was storm damage. There was some of the railings were bent. There was a huge rock that was misplaced and fell that weighed like several tons. So obviously something had to shake it. There were ropes that were supposed to tie, you know, ships coming that were strewn all over the place. They were supposed to be kept in a box in a crate, but the box is missing. So, I mean, there's definitely stormy weather there, but I don't see, if this was so stormy, why would these experienced lighthouse keepers go out into the storm? And also, I mean, there's very strict regulations that you are not to leave the lighthouse unmanned. So all three of them should not have been, if for some reason they did have to go out in the storm for some reason, all three of them, various regulations for them to go out. So, I mean, they were very experienced. They knew their main duty above all else was to keep the light going. So a hard storm did hit the island lighthouse on the 20th of December, but there is evidence that shows that the disappearance likely happened days before this, even as early as the 15th when the last journal entry was made, because the 15th was the first time that people on passing ships noticed that the lighthouse was not emitting any actual light, that it was dark from that period on. So all signs point that these guys disappeared before this big storm even hit them. So what do you guys think about that?
I mean, I think you said it. It doesn't make very much sense that all three of them would be out on the turf in the middle of a storm. There's no logical explanation as to why they would do that.
I mean, this... Obviously, if you think of, you know, a stormy lighthouse, I mean, the lighthouse was set... I mean, there's about at least 100 feet of cliffs up from the, leading up that sheet, you know, steer cliff.
Yeah, exactly.
So lighthouses perch up pretty high. So it's not like these guys were right in the shoreline or anything. If it was stormy, I don't see why they would go out near the edge or...
I mean, I think that's...
On the dot.
Plausible, but it there's no real reason for it to happen.
Right. So, I mean, once again, that's plausible. I have some problems with it, though. All right, so on to the last theory, which is probably the most likely, and it was that a rogue wave managed hit the island and swept them all aboard. So a rogue wave is basically a phenomenon where you get a freak wave that is suddenly 10 to 20 times the normal size of what all the other waves are at that location. So, I mean, this wave would have been at least over 200 feet tall, and for some reason, these men were outside, and this wave came, and before they could hide or get back to shelter, this wave just came and splashed down and pulled them out into the sea. So, I mean, that is very likely. Actually, up until, I think it's past couple of decades, that rogue waves weren't even proven able to be detected using scientific equipment.
I'm looking at pictures of Eileen Moore Island, and I just don't see how that makes any sense at all, that a wave big enough to come up the side of these cliffs and supposedly wash all three of these men out of lighthouse or off the ground and into the water and have their bodies not turn up.
Yeah. I can see a wave like definitely hitting, maybe cresting to get on top of the lighthouse, but I don't see strong enough where it could actually just sweep them completely over the surface of the island.
I mean, I think all these storm theories are pretty weak, honestly. And, I mean, yeah, there's clearly, it's a lighthouse. There's going to be tons of storms, high winds, large waves. But I think this is probably more of a man-made issue. I think after listening to your first theory and then comparing it to these, I think something along the lines of the first theory is more likely. It seems like this had human elements to it where some pieces of evidence were particularly hidden.
Definitely rogue waves do exist, and I mean, there's possible that one of these waves hit the island. You have to remember that, so two of the oilskin suits were missing.
Right.
So that means that probably two of the guys were out outside at one time. But the third was there. So the third guy, the only way I can see it is if a wave or storm hit and one or two of the guys outside were in danger, the third guy inside saw it and rushed outside, hence the overturned chair, and ran out to help them. But then also you have to remember, I mean, like the doors were all shut. So it's like you have the overturned chair, which is like someone's in a big hurry, but then closing the doors and all the gates behind them. So I mean, like I said, from a more practical or scientific mind view, possibly, I think the most likely is some kind of weather, but I definitely can see that there's some human element. I couldn't find anything about their backstory or any personality problems that they had. I don't think any of them had any criminal records for any reason, but I mean, there is a chance that one of them just got cabin fever, so to speak, and just decided to take out his two lighthouse keeper friends and then jumped over the cliff himself.
So I think, in conclusion, the most likely explanation is that two of the men were outside and one had to rush out in order to try and save them, and somehow their bodies were washed away.
Yeah.
Probably related to the weather, but probably in combination with...
Yeah, I don't know if it was a big storm or a rogue wave or some kind of combination of the two, but yeah, I think it's the same thing where maybe only one or two was in trouble to begin with. The third guy rushed out for some reason and tried to save them or perhaps warn them. But then whatever it was that hit that island, able to sweep all three of them into the sea and pull them from enough distance away that they were never washed ashore again. But, I mean, this is a very famous disappearance in the United Kingdom and Scotland.
I think we did ignore a key element, though. There are these telltales of groups of little people who resided on this island and that had these strange magical powers. And while a little far-fetched, I do like to offer all sides of the argument.
Yeah, I mean, there are a few more supernatural theories, such as UFOs, but I don't buy into any of the evidence of that. But yeah, I mean, this place definitely does have a haunted past. And, I mean, it's been feared by locals for centuries, and perhaps there's some kind of energy coming from the island that managed to, you know, get to these guys, or at least one of them, and turn them into a violent person. Far-fetched. I mean, all these theories have some holes in them, but...
A lot of holes.
I'm more willing to take some kind of rogue wave or storm over little people, or possession, or, you know, some kind of demonic possession or something.
Yeah, I would favor nature over theory or the supernatural, paranormal, or whatever you want to put it, any day.
Yeah, I mean, I do.
You can actually see nature.
This is one of my favorite unsolved mysteries, and I've, you know, read up on it for a while. I do kind of go back and forth on my theories. I do have problems with each of them, but I think the most likely explanation is a more nature-based. There is some kind of either wave or storm that somehow managed to wash these guys to sea.
So let's bring it on back down to Earth a little bit, moving on to Eric's unsolved disappearance, the story of Zeb Quinn. On January 2nd, 2000, at 9 o'clock p.m. in Asheville, North Carolina, 18-year-old Zeb was leaving work at a local Walmart and going to meet his friend Robert Jason Owens in order for them to look at purchasing a Mitsubishi Eclipse that was for sale. He was driving in his truck and received a page and flashed his lights at Owen, who was driving in front of him, and they subsequently pulled off the road and found a payphone. After the call, Zeb had a strange, kind of perturbed look on his face and then accidentally rear-ended Owen's truck from behind before apologizing, and then both of them, after this brief incident, drove away. And that was the last that was ever seen of Zeb Quinn. A few days later, Quinn called in sick to work. However, his supervisor stated that he didn't think it sounded like Zeb. They later traced the call to Owens, who explained that Quinn had asked him to make the call. The police were suspicious of this. Additionally, Owens had received treatment for broken ribs and a head injury the morning after Quinn had disappeared. Owens' explanation was that he was involved in an unrelated fender bender, and since then has refused to cooperate with police in any way.
So he said that he was rear-ended by Quinn and then had another unrelated accident?
Yes. That's exactly it.
He's on a tire.
Sounds a little fishy.
A strange story indeed, especially given that they were allegedly friends.
Yeah.
It was noted that Owen's injuries were not consistent with the minor accident that he claimed had occurred. A brief investigation ensued, and it was revealed that Quinn had a romantic relationship with a woman named Misty Taylor, who had a jealous and abusive ex-boyfriend, Wesley Smith. This individual made multiple threats against Quinn. Quinn had shared these threats with his family and co-workers, however, refused to distance himself from the female. Phone records later indicated that the phone call Quinn received initially was from his aunt, who wasn't home at the time because she was visiting with Misty Taylor and her family. Does get weird. Gets very intricate, but you have no idea how weird it gets from here on out. 2 weeks later, Quinn's abandoned car was found in a parking lot with a pair of lips and two exclamation points written on the back window in lipstick. A number of items that did not belong to Quinn were found inside the truck. A jacket, unidentified hotel room key, and a 3-month-old Labrador puppy. Go figure. Alive and happy, I might add. The car seat had been adjusted for someone shorter than Quinn, which is also an interesting
fact. Yeah, that's just a whole, this guy goes missing and then, you know, car pops up a few weeks later.
Somebody's been driving.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like someone was trying to definitely leave a message, either to the police or to Quinn's family or something.
That's spot on, because the parking lot where the truck was found was actually located right across the street from where Quinn's family had been working. They were actually, some of his sisters and mother were NICU nurses.
Yeah, that definitely sounds deliberate.
Sounds like somebody was trying to send a message. So this case went unresolved for over 15 years. And in June of 2015, a woman familiar with Robert Owens, who was Quinn's friend that was involved in the fender bender, reported to authorities that there was an abandoned fish pond project Owens had started after Quinn had disappeared. It's kind of a red flag right there. Why would anybody start working on a...
Yeah, you know, someone close to you goes missing, and all of a sudden you start digging a big hole in your backyard. That should have raised some questions back then. The fact that it took 15 years is kind of a shame.
It is kind of a shame. But anyways, an investigator searched the property and found 15-year-old fabric that had been buried in this layer of concrete. And it's currently believed to belong to Quinn. Now, this was just a few months ago, I'll remind you. And they also found pulverized lime or powder mortar mix that's alleged to be human bones. However, this has not been confirmed. Owens was actually charged in a March 2015 unrelated murder case of Joseph J.T. Codd and his pregnant wife, Christy Schoen Codd, in which he dismembered their bodies and attempted to destroy them by placing the remains in a wood stove on Owens' property. The Codd family had actually hired Owens to do some work for them, and for some reason he had decided to slaughter the family.
Okay, I thought there was just some, he just randomly decided, I don't know, he had some kind of connection to the
family. Yeah, he was hired and he was on their property doing work for them when he decided to slaughter them.
Definitely sounds like he's the one of the main suspects.
There's a number of red flags, but I believe it's more intricate than that.
Can't see him yet. It's pointing right to him so far.
Yeah. Well, he was charged with 2 counts of first-degree murder for that case and murder of an unborn child. And additionally, he'd spent nearly 2 years in jail for various other crimes in the past. So this guy's got a huge rap sheet. But there was also some evidence to suggest that there might have been multiple suspects involved. And based on this story, I think one of the other suspects was probably Misty Taylor's ex-boyfriend, Wesley Smith.
I mean, you definitely have a motive there. Plus, there was, you know, he told his family about the threats from this Wesley character. Definitely with the car leaving and the parking lot near the hospital where his Quinn's family work definitely does seem like a deliberate message to his family, some kind of warning. I mean, the big old lips drawn.
But what about this puppy? What does that even mean?
I don't know. Just everything in that car is weird. You got the puppy, you got the hotel key that they could never figure out what hotel it belonged to. You had a jacket. No, that wasn't Quinn's jacket, right? It was just some...
Right, it was a... None of the stuff in the car belonged to Quinn.
Yeah, so I mean, it was kind of like someone had been living in it for a couple weeks or just been using it. Yeah, that's one of the strangest parts about this whole thing. I mean, besides the guy just completely disappearing, is that just this strange car. I don't know if the person found the car and it is completely unrelated. Like, you know, his kids just... They found this abandoned car and decided to draw stuff on it.
I think it's too convenient for it to be located across from the hospital where the family
It's almost too much of a coincidence.
Someone was definitely trying to send a message.
Yeah.
I think it's a real shame that this truck was missing for 2 weeks, especially after all the red flags that were raised by Owens, the friend.
Well, that's the problem, is that a lot of this information at the beginning is based on Owens' word, since he was the last one to see Quinn. And then you just get him rear-ending Owens' truck and then just speeding off. And
well, they got out of the car, talked about it, wasn't a big deal, and they drove off.
Right.
But, I mean, it seems pretty obvious to me that Owens is a psychopath and he has murderous tendencies, probably a short temper.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely... I think Owens is... just because he is a murderer, is probably the prime suspect.
Yeah.
What his motive is, exactly, I don't see. At least the Wesley guy had a motive and perhaps ambushed Quinn as he was coming home or wherever he was going. Maybe come across this Wesley guy and he managed to get him out of his car for some reason and kill him. and then stowed his car in the parking lot near the hospital. I mean, so that's a possibility. But, I mean, definitely Owens, just because he is a murderer, is, I think, the most likely suspect in this case.
I agree.
All right, so that's a pretty strange disappearance. Hopefully, if Owens did do it, he will confess and we'll have some closure on this case, which has gained some popularity in the past year. So yeah, that's a pretty good story there. So now for our final case of unsolved disappearances, we have Ethan.
Yeah, so I did something that is pretty famous in American history. At least it was taught when we were kids growing up. The Lost Colony.
Right.
So a little background. The Roanoke Colony, also known as the Lost Colony, established on Roanoke Island in what is today's Dare County, which is the Outer Banks of North Carolina, was a late 16th century attempt by Queen Elizabeth I, who's the Queen of England, to establish a permanent settlement there. The colony was founded by Sir Walter Raleigh. The colonists disappeared during the Anglo-Spanish War, 3 years after the last shipment of supplies from England. Their disappearance gave rise to the nickname of the Lost Colony, and to this day, there has been no conclusive evidence as to what happened to the colonists.
So what was the time span from the last people who saw them, or at least confirmed they were alive, and then the people who discovered them?
It was 3 years from the last shipment.
Okay.
So but the time frame we're looking at here is the late 1580s to early 1590s.
Okay. I think that, you know, these colonists were stranded here for years. By the time that they left, they were already in a dire situation. And you fast forward 3 years. I mean, if they're running out of food and supplies, and the area, you know, they're surrounded by hostile natives, they're not getting enough, you know, crops or food in there. So, I mean, I think they just packed up and made a gamble and try to travel to another location.
So what does Croatan mean then?
I have no idea. I mean, I think that's one of the big mysteries is, I mean, for all we know, you know, a Native American could have carved that, or something, or I have no...
I believe it was written in English.
Well, then I have no idea. I mean, are there any theories on what that word means, or...?
Well, Croatan was actually, the Croatan people.
Yeah.
So...
So basically, they just carved the name of one of the tribes
into
the tree. Yeah, I mean, they could left that as possibly as a warning sign, or, you know, as an explanation, or, I mean, somebody could just carve that name into a tree and it doesn't really have any big, you know,
significance. Yeah. So am I correct in my logic that it was carved in English, therefore one of the colonists
It was, the research was in parentheses Croatan, so that was the actual word carved into the tree.
Now, you have some...
Or post.
I don't want to steal any of your thunder, Ethan, but to me, that suggests that the colony was possibly wiped out. And instead of carving the cross, they carved the name of the culprits.
It's possible. It's later on, as I talk into the possibilities and the hypotheses of their disappearance, it's one of those does come up.
Yeah, let's get into your theories that you researched.
Well, before that, still during this time.
Okay.
My man here, Raleigh, is going to conduct some stuff. So 12 years went by after this initial disappearance discovery. Raleigh decided to find out what happened to the colony himself. Led by Samuel Mace, this 1602 expedition differed from previous voyages in that Raleigh bought his own ship and guaranteed the sailors wages so they wouldn't have to worry about privateering. However, Raleigh still hoped to make money from the trip, and Mace's ship landed in the Outer Banks to gather aromatic woods and plants to, I guess, fund everything. Raleigh was unable to find any significant, though, I guess, what am I looking for?
Evidence?
Yeah, there we go. Evidence on the disappearance of his people. Meanwhile, the Spanish had different reasons for wanting to find the colony. Knowing of Raleigh's plans to use Roanoke as a base for privateering, they were hoping to destroy it. Moreover, they had been getting mostly inaccurate reports of activities there, and they imagined the colony to be far more successful than it actually was. In 1590, they found the remnants of the colony purely by accident, but assumed it was only an outlying base of the main settlement, which they believed was in the Chesapeake Bay area.
So wait, the Spanish were looking for the colony, they found it, the abandoned colony, but just assumed it was an outpost and not the real colony?
Correct.
So they succeeded in their mission. They found the colony and it was already destroyed for them. So in a way, I mean...
But they didn't know that was the colony.
Right, but I mean...
They you know, I guess...
Yeah, but I just, I mean, that's...
Well, you know, yeah, I mean, yeah, you're right.
I mean, the Spaniards already had the advantage before they even got there just because this colony was gone.
Yeah. Alright, so... Hypotheses about the disappearance. The end of the 1587 colony is unrecorded, leading to the colony being referred to as the Lost Colony, with multiple hypotheses existing as to the fate of the colonists. This is still from back then, not recent. These are reports from John Smith and William Strachey regarding the Lost Colony. Once the Jamestown settlement was established in 1607, efforts were undertaken by the English to acquire information from the Powhatan tribe about the 1587 Lost Colony. The first definitive information concerning the fate of the Lost Colony came from Captain John Smith, leader of the Jamestown Colony from 1608 to 1609. According to the chronicler Samuel Purchase, Smith learned from Chief Powhatan that he had personally conducted the slaughter of the Lost Colonists. This shocking information was reported to England, and by the spring of 1609, King James and the Royal Council were convinced that Chief Powhatan was responsible for the slaughter of the Lost Colony. The second source of Chief Powhatan's involvement in the fate of the Lost Colony was William Strachey, secretary of the Jamestown Colony in 1610 through 11. Strachey's The History of Travail into Virginia Britannia seemed to confirm Smith's report and provided additional information. The colonists had been living peacefully among a group of natives beyond Powhatan's domain for more than 20 years when they were massacred. Furthermore, Powhatan himself seemed to have directed the slaughter because of prophecies by his priests, which were that a tribe outside of his would overthrow him.
Right.
So he wanted to, you know...
Nip that in the bud.
Rumors about possible survivors of the massacre led to several search expeditions, but no trace of the colonists have ever been found. So, another theory is that they integrated with local tribes. So, there are multiple accounts of assimilation with various tribes from around the area of the original Roanoke settlement, from them being held captive to full-on assimilation, where there are accounts of gray-eyed American Indians who claim to be descendants of these colonists. Other theories that came out through all this was maybe they tried sailing back and they got lost at sea.
With what? They have a boat?
You can make a boat. It'd take a while, but you can make a boat.
To sail to England? And those things are complex, no. I don't buy that theory at all. Yeah, I mean, my opinion, the assimilation, either voluntary or forced, is probably the most likely cause, whether the colonists knew that they weren't going to survive much longer and made some kind of truce with the natives and agreed to live together, or perhaps...
They surrendered themselves.
Yeah. Or, I mean, the Native Americans could have slaughter all the men and just, and you know, taking the women and children themselves.
Right.
And so, you know, these 10, 20 years later, you might have descendants, but you don't know if those were, you know, if those couplings between the natives and the English people were forced or voluntary.
Yeah. Another theory that came out through all this, those pesky Spanish, They say that the Spanish could have destroyed the colony. Earlier in the century, the Spanish did destroy evidence of a French colony of Fort Charles in coastal South Carolina and massacred the inhabitants of Fort Caroline, a French colony near present-day Jacksonville. However, a Spanish attack is unlikely, as the Spanish were still looking for the English colony.
Yeah, I was going to say, the only way I can see that is if a Spanish warship arrived, they somehow managed to slaughter the 100 or so colonists and then left, and then their ship sunk, and they, you know, couldn't spread the news. So as far as the Spaniards were concerned, the colony was still alive and well.
Right. So there has been archaeological evidence now lately, the past 20 years, on the matter. In 1998, East Carolina University organized the Croatan Project, an archaeological investigation into the events at Roanoke. The excavation team sent to the island uncovered a 10-karat gold 16th-century English ring, gun flints, and two copper farthings at the site of the ancient Croatan capital.
Well, I think, I mean, regardless of what happened to the colonists, if they were slaughtered or assimilated, it's pretty easy to say that one way or the other, the natives would have come and, you know, taken their gold and their gun equipment and all that and brought it back to their capital. So, I mean, regardless of the fate of the actual colonists, I can see that's pretty easily explained. It doesn't necessarily mean that they were assimilated. It's just, I mean, the natives were going to take whatever was at the colony if it was left empty.
Other things, such as climate. Also in 1998, a team from University of Arkansas, the Department of Geography, and the Center for Archaeological Research at the College of William & Mary used tree ring cores from 800-year-old bald cypresses taken from the Roanoke Island area of North Carolina. And through these, they determined that there was a pretty serious drought going around in this area.
Right.
So, I mean, that further, you know, could lend to just, like, starvation, but still, you would think bodies would...
Yeah, I mean, I think that just leads back into my primary theory has kind of always been that they just ran out of resources and they took their chances and just packed. They got as much material as they could together and just, you know, took a trek somewhere and tried to find a better land than where they were at. Mm-hmm. They were running out of resources. The relief ship was nowhere in sight. They waited for years, possibly, and people were probably dying. They couldn't wait any longer, and they just grabbed everything they could and moved on. And perhaps some of them were captured or willingly went to the natives to explain the mixed offspring.
Right. Yeah, I agree. There's probably a fair amount of colonists who were unable to make the trek and decided to stick around for whatever reason or were captured. And that explains the assimilation and the gray-eyed Indians.
I mean, you could have a combination. You could have a split in the colony that, you know, they might decide, what are we going to do? And some might think we're going to die here, so they leave and make their lives somewhere else, and maybe a few got left behind, and they either eventually got slaughtered or they gave in too and went and, made a truce with the natives to go live with them. I mean, there's no real strong evidence to definitely, you know, make one of these theories the real one, but I think it's something along those lines.
Let me impart some knowledge on you here. Just in the last 6 months, there has been more recent archaeological evidence discovered. I don't know if y'all heard this in the news. I remember hearing it, but wasn't really paying attention at the time. Apparently, there have been two different excavation sites. One around the city that I was just talking about, that was 50 miles from 50 miles north of Roanoke Island, and they also did one 50 miles inland. So the 50 miles north site, they found a small piece of slate that seems to have been used as a writing tablet and part of the hilt of an iron rapier, a light sword similar to those used in England in the 16th century, along with other artifacts of European and Native American origin. The slate, a smaller version of a similar one found in Jamestown, bears a small letter M still barely visible in one corner. It was found alongside a lead pencil. Now, they're just thinking, at least at this site, that the colonists, you know, kind of packed up their things, and they moved in with the Indians, but brought their stuff and kept their stuff. And Site X, as the other place is known, kind of pulled up the same kind of stuff. So recent evidence is leading towards assimilation.
Yeah.
Members of both teams, though, admit that they can't claim to have solved the vexing riddle of the lost colony, and many of their colleagues are skeptical that the artifacts can be definitively tied to these colonists, given difficulties of dating these items.
I was going
to
say, I mean, they could have come from anywhere, or just like I said earlier, when different artifacts were found at the native capital, is that any, you know, it could have been any number, either a few colonists or it could have been Native Americans that took these things and went somewhere and dropped them. So I don't think there's any proof there that the entire colony relocated somewhere.
Yeah. It's the most plausible, I think, though. I mean, I would say most of them assimilated, took their chance, found that if they got along with a group of Indians just to join their culture, maybe, you know, sprinkle in some of their ideas into it.
Right. I mean, there's definitely bad blood, but I mean, like I said earlier, the colonists were in deep trouble in their situation there, and I think they definitely could have made a truce with the Native Americans, and in return for giving them their, you know, firearms and all the silver cups they wanted, that the natives would have, you know, allowed them to assimilate a bit, or at least move to a different location near the native settlements, and they all kind of just lived together and started, you know, breeding together, and that's what
it became one happy family.
Exactly.
That's all I have.
All right. So, yeah, thanks for listening. That's three cases of unsolved disappearances.
And thanks for listening to our episode of the Strange Matters podcast. If you would like to reach us to send feedback, suggestions, or further discussion of the episode's topics, please reach us at strangematterspodcast@gmail.com or reach us on our Facebook page. If you're listening to us on iTunes, please rate us and leave us a review. It helps promote the podcast and helps us reach more listeners. Take it easy, everybody.
Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you next episode.